Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, let's start right up with the public health news and research roundup, where I gather all things wonderful in the wonderful world of public health for you so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
Okay, first up, an interesting story on the connection between pipelines and sexual violence. It's kind of a little unusual to tie together toxic masculinity, energy extraction, climate change, and violence. But here goes from the New Republic. In 2017, 5,646 Native women were reported missing in the United States. Nationwide, the murder rate for Native women is 10 times that of the average American. In Montana, Native citizens are 6.7% of the population, yet between 2016 and 2018, they made up 26% of the state's missing persons reports. Some of the factors are easy to identify. Jurisdictional confusion between local state-run police, the FBI, and tribal or Bureau of Indian Affairs police departments, which routinely leads to slow response times. Slow response times allow for bodies, and thus a perpetrator's DNA, to decompose and disappear. And slow response times lead to cold trails and dead-end cases, which make local law enforcement hesitant to undertake new cases. In 2017, U.S. attorneys declined to prosecute 37% of Indian Country cases, citing lack of evidence in 70% of the cases they dropped. Pipelines, a growing body of research suggests, can actually fuel violence against Native women. Man camps, also described as work camp modular housing, are temporary housing communities set up for the well-paid, typically male laborers that are tasked with constructing pipelines, snaking their way above, across, and below our nation's waterways and lands. More often than not, these routes, and as a result the man camps, find themselves cutting through or just outside of rural tribal nation lands and other marginalized communities. A number of studies, reports, and congressional hearings now connect man camps, which can be used in mines and other extractive efforts as well, with increased rates of sexual violence and sex trafficking. The most documented cases thus far have occurred in the tar sands region of Alberta, Canada, as well as the western North Dakota and eastern Montana, an area known otherwise as the Bakken oil fields, although such activities in no way exclusive to that region. Because pipelines are typically routed through rural communities, local law enforcement, oftentimes already stretched thin, are left trying to police a sudden months-long influx of hundreds of outsiders. This was among the many points underscored in June when Canada's federal government released its MMIWG report, a years-long study undertaken by the federal government that declared the missing and murdered Indigenous women epidemic, a state-induced genocide. Among the findings presented in the 1,200-page document, the Canadian government pinpointed extractive industries and man camps as hotbeds of violence. The problem, as always in Indian Country, is getting American politicians to care about human beings more than campaign contributions. As it stands, U.S. officials, rather than heeding these side effects of the nation's addiction to oil and natural gas, are instead focusing on fighting protesters. Okay, and another law enforcement-related story from Kaiser Health News, taking the cops out of mental health-related 9/11 rescues. Over 8 million people struggle with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder in America, and an estimated 40% of people diagnosed with schizophrenia go untreated, according to the Treatment Advocacy Center, a nonprofit focused on mental health. Individuals with those illnesses often lose the ability to realize their deficits, creating a roadblock in accessing care and attending medical or court appointments. Low-level offenses can land those with paranoia, hallucinations, or a reduced ability to communicate in the criminal justice system. An estimated 383,000 people with severe mental illnesses are behind bars nationwide, while only a tenth of that number are in state hospitals. One in four deaths from police shootings represent people with mental illness, according to the Treatment Advocacy Center. People with severe mental illness are more than 10 times more likely to be victims of a violent crime than the general population, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Nationally, police officers carry the brunt of responding to mental health issues. In 2017, law enforcement agencies spent $918 million transporting people with severe mental illnesses, according to a 2019 survey from the Treatment Advocacy Center. It also estimated that officers spend 21% of their time responding to and transferring people for mental health issues. We need to start dealing with mental health issues not as a law enforcement issue, but as a public health issue. Okay, and also sticking somewhat with the law enforcement and health connection, here we got from ProPublica, which is an investigative reporting organization. When medical debt collectors decide who gets arrested. Across the country, thousands of people are jailed each year for failing to appear in court for unpaid bills, an arrangement set up much like this one. The practice spread in the wake of the recession as collectors found judges willing to use their broad powers of contempt to wield the threat of arrest. Judges have issued warrants for people who owe money to landlords and payday lenders, who never paid off furniture or daycare fees or federal student loans. Some debtors who have been arrested owed as little as $28. More than half of the debt in collection stems from medical care, which, unlike most other debt, is often taken on without a choice or an understanding of the costs. Since the Affordable Act of 2010, insurers have nearly tripled deductibles, the amount a person pays before their coverage kicks in, and raised premiums and copays as well. As a result, tens of millions of people without adequate coverage are expected to pay larger portions of their rising bills. The sickest patients are often the most indebted, and they're not exempt from arrest. In Indiana, a cancer patient was hauled away from home in her pajamas in front of her three children. Too weak to climb down the stairs to the women's area of the jail, she spent the night in a men's mental health unit where an inmate smeared feces on the wall. In Utah, a man who had ignored orders to appear over an unpaid ambulance bill told friends he would rather die than go to jail. The day he was arrested, he snuck poison into the cell and ended his life. In jurisdictions with lax laws and willing judges, jail is a logical endpoint of a system that has automated the steps from high bills to debt to court, and that has given collectors power that is often unchecked. With hardly any oversight, even by the presiding judge, collection attorneys have turned this courtroom into a government-sanctioned shakedown of the uninsured and underinsured, while the leverage is the debtor's liberty. Allowing bail money to count towards collections raises some of the most critical legal questions. Peter Holland, a former director of the Consumer Protection Clinic at the University of Maryland Law School, explained that this practice reveals that jailing is not about contempt, but about collection. Most judges will tell you, I'm working for the rule of law, and if you don't show up and you were summoned, there have to be consequences. He explained, but the proof is in the pudding. If the judge is upholding the law, he would give the bail money back to you when you appear in court. Instead, he is using his power to take money from you and hand it to the debt collector. It raises constitutional questions. Congress has not acted on advocates' calls to amend the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act to prohibit collectors from requesting warrants. There are also no current efforts to bar nonprofit hospitals or medical providers that receive funds through Medicare or Medicaid from seeking warrants. Some states have reformed their laws to make sure defendants are properly served or to prohibit wage garnishments for debt. But legal experts on collections say that more remains to be done, like taking jail out of the equation and instead requiring debtors to sign a financial affidavit or a promise to appear. Debt collection is an $11 billion industry involving nearly 8,000 firms across the country. Medical debt makes up almost half of what's collected each year. Today, millions of debt collection suits are overwhelming state courts. The practice is considered a race of the diligent, where every creditor is rushing to the courthouse, hustling to get the first judgment in order to be the first to collect on a debtor's asset. Well, that's a pernicious intersection of our crappy law enforcement and court system with a crappy healthcare system that drives people into debt. Okay, next up from Science Daily. And this story, I think, is a really good example of why the concern for inequalities is at the heart of public health practice. Children's risk of dying before age 5 varies more than 40-fold. An unprecedented study mapping child deaths over almost two decades finds that nearly half of the 5.4 million under 5 years of age deaths in 2017 can be attributed to differences in child death rates within and across countries. The study is the first of its kind, mapping child deaths in 99 low- and middle-income countries at the level of individual districts. Published in the journal Nature, the finding includes precision maps illuminating health disparities within countries and regions, often obscured by national-level analysis. An interactive visualization accompanying the research compares child death rates from year to year. The research, conducted by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington School of Medicine, looks at countries where more than 90% of child deaths occurred in 2017. Mortality rates varied as much as tenfold between districts within a country. Across all countries studied, the likelihood of a child dying before age varied more than 40-fold at the district level. It is as reprehensible as it is tragic that, on average, nearly 15,000 children under age 5 die every day, said Dr. Simon Hay, the senior author of the study and director of the local burden of disease group. Why are some areas doing so well while others struggle? In order to make progress, we need to enable precise targeting interventions, such as vaccines. Our findings provide a platform for nation's health ministers, clinicians, and others to make focused improvements in health systems. Globally, approximately 5.4 million children died before their fifth birthdays in 2017, as compared to 9.7 million in 2000. Researchers estimated that if every district in the low- and middle-income countries studied had met the Sustainable Development Goal target of at least as low as 25 child deaths per 1,000 live births, 2.6 million fewer children would have died. The vast majority of the 17,554 districts among the 99 nations studied saw improvement in lowering child deaths, but levels of inequality between districts were more variable over the study period. Despite major gains in reducing child deaths over the past 20 years, the highest rates of death in 2017 were still largely concentrated where rates were highest in 2000. And one interesting and encouraging finding is that in 43 countries studied, the district with the worst child mortality rate in 2017 was still better than the district with the best child mortality rate in 2000. Progress, but very uneven. So goes public health problems. Okay, next up from the World Health Organization. 7 million people receive record levels of life-saving TB treatment, but 3 million still miss out. More people receiving life-saving treatment for tuberculosis, TB, in 2018 than ever before, largely due to improved detection and diagnosis. Globally, 7 million people were diagnosed and treated for TB, up from 6.4 million in 2017, enabling the world to meet one of the milestones towards the United Nations Political Declaration targets on TB. World Health Organization's latest global TB report says that 2018 also saw a reduction in the number of TB deaths. 1.5 million people died from TB in 2018, down from 1.6 million in 2017. The number of new cases of TB has been declining steadily in recent years. However, the burden remains high among low-income and marginalized communities and populations. Around 10 million people developed TB in 2018. Today we mark the passing of the first milestone in the effort to reach people who have been missing out on services to prevent and treat TB, said the World Health Organization Director General. This is proof that we can reach global targets if we join forces together, as we have done through the Find, Treat All, End TB joint initiative of the World Health Organization, the Stop TB Partnership, and the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria. The World Health Organization's latest global TB report highlights that the world must accelerate progress if it is to reach the Sustainable Development Goal of ending TB by 2030. The report also notes that an estimated 3 million of those with TB are not getting the care they need. In many countries today, fragile health infrastructure and workforce shortages make it difficult to provide timely diagnosis and the right treatments for TB. Further, up to 80% of TB patients in high-burden countries spend more than 20% of their annual household income on treating the disease. About one quarter of the world's population has latent TB, which means people have been infected by TB bacteria, but they are not yet ill with the disease and cannot transmit it. Okay, next up, some good news from the World Health Organization. Two out of three wild poliovirus strains declared eradicated. In a historic announcement on World Polio Day, an independent commission of experts concluded that wild poliovirus type 3 has been eradicated worldwide. Following the eradication of smallpox and wild poliovirus type 2, this news represents a historic achievement for humanity. There are three individual and immunologically distinct wild poliovirus strains: wild poliovirus type 1, type 2, and type 3. Symptomatically, all three strains are identical in that they cause irreversible paralysis and even death, but there are genetic and virologic differences that make these three strains three separate viruses that must each be eradicated individually. This is a significant achievement that should reinvigorate the eradication process and provides motivation for the final step, the eradication of wild poliovirus type 1. This virus remains in circulation in just two countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan. We cannot stop our efforts now. We must eradicate all remaining strains of all polioviruses. Eradicating wild poliovirus 3 proves that a polio-free world is achievable. The polio eradication efforts have saved the world more than $27 billion in health costs since 1988. A sustained polio-free world will generate a further savings of $14 billion by 2050, compared to the cost countries would incur for controlling the virus indefinitely. Okay, next up from Kaiser Health News. Fear of falling: how hospitals do even more harm by keeping patients in bed. Falls remain the leading cause of fatal and non-fatal injuries for older Americans. Hospitals face financial penalties when they occur. Nurses and aides get blamed or reprimanded if a patient under their supervision hits the ground. But hospitals have become so overzealous in fall prevention that they're producing an epidemic of immobility, experts say. To ensure that patients will never fall, hospitalized patients who could benefit from activity are told not to get up on their own. Their bed-bound state, reinforced by bed alarms and a lack of staff to help them move around. That's especially dangerous for older patients, often weak to begin with. After just a few days of bed rest, their muscles can deteriorate enough to bring severe long-term consequences. Older patients face staggering rates of disability after hospitalization, said Dr. Kenneth Kovinsky, a geriatrician and researcher at the University of San Francisco, California. His research found that one-third of patients aged 70 and older leave the hospital more disabled than when they arrived. While lying there, older patients often find themselves tracked by alarms that bleep or shriek when they try to get up or move. These alarms are designed to alert nurses so they can supervise the patient to safely walk, but research has shown that the alarms don't prevent falls. Often stretched thin, nurses are deluged by many types of alarms and can't always dash to the bedside before a patient hits the ground. Dr. Cynthia Brown, a professor at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, has identified common reasons older patients stay in bed. They feel too much pain, fatigue, or weakness. They have IV lines or catheters that make it more difficult to walk. There's not enough staff to help them, or they feel they're burdening nurses if they ask for help. And walking down the hallway in flimsy gowns with messy hair can be embarrassing, she added. Yet walking even a little can pay off. Older patients who walk just 275 steps a day in the hospital show lower rates of readmission after 30 days, research has found. And in a related story, exercise can reduce artery stiffness associated with heart failure. This from Science Daily. Generally, exercise is considered good for you. However, physicians and medical doctors previously prescribed bed rest to people with heart failure, fearing exercise could potentially lead to additional health problems. People with heart failure cannot do everything that a healthy individual can. So the question becomes, how much exercise can they handle and what type of impact will it have on their health? We found that regardless of intensity level, some type of physical activity was good for heart health compared to no exercise at all. A good lesson to learn. Use it or lose it. Okay. This, also from Science Daily, a very good study about a common practice or treatment, high blood pressure, and gives us a very simple way to make it more effective. This also from Science Daily. Largest study finds greater reduction in risk of cardiovascular disease and death from bedtime rather than morning medication. People with high blood pressure who take all their antihypertensive medication in one go at bedtime have better controlled blood pressure and a significantly lower risk of death or illness caused by heart or blood vessel problems compared to those who take their medication in the morning, according to new research. The researchers, who are part of the Hygieia project led by Professor Ramon Hermida, director of the Bioengineering Chronobiology Labs at the University of Vigo, Spain, found that patients who took their medication at bedtime had nearly half the risk, a 45% reduction, of dying from or suffering heart attacks, myocardial infarction, stroke, heart failure, or requiring a procedure to unblock narrowed arteries, compared to patients who took their medication on waking. The researchers had adjusted their analysis to take account of factors that could affect the results, such as age, gender, type 2 diabetes, kidney disease, smoking, and cholesterol levels. When they looked at individual outcomes, they found that the risk of death from heart or blood vessel problems was reduced by 66%. The risk of myocardial infarction was reduced by 44%, coronary revascularization by 40%, heart failure by 42%, and stroke by 49%. Professor Hermida said, "Current guidelines on the treatment of hypertension do not mention or recommend any preferred treatment time. Morning ingestion has been the most common recommendation by physicians based on the misleading goal of reducing morning blood pressure levels. However, the Hygieia project has reported previously that average systolic blood pressure when a person is asleep is the most significant and independent indication of cardiovascular disease risk, regardless of blood pressure measurements taken while awake or when visiting a doctor. Furthermore, there are no studies showing that treating hypertension in the morning improves a reduction in the risk of cardiovascular disease. The results of this study show that patients who routinely take their antihypertensive medication at bedtime, as opposed to when they wake up, have better controlled blood pressure and, most importantly, a significantly decreased risk of death or illness from heart and blood vessel problems." Okay, moving on to a story from Stat News. Okay, this one's about sexism in health. Well, and also racism, I suppose. Let's get the isms out. Doctors argue for term limits to diversify medical school leadership. Earlier this year, the National Institutes of Health announced that the agency's nearly 300 laboratory and branch chiefs will be limited to 12-year terms to increase the gender and racial diversity among leadership. But in general, the idea of term limits to encourage diversity has been slow to catch on in other research settings, especially medical schools. Among department chairs and other leaders in academic medicine, there is a large gender and racial disparity. Women make up only 18% of medical school deans, while those from other underrepresented minority groups account for 12% of deans. A new perspective paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine argues that without a policy shift to set term limits and rectify these gaps, academic medicine won't reach gender parity for another 50 years. At that point, even the youngest physicians, those who are in medical school now, would be past retirement. The paper's authors, all of whom are physicians, looked at more than 2,100 clinical department chairs across various medical schools in the U.S. and found that men, on average, served as deans for about 9 years compared to women 6 years. Among those who served as department chairs for at least 12 years, only 7% were women, and fewer than 10% were not white or Asian. Stat spoke with Dr. Reshma Jagzi, a radiation oncologist at Michigan Medicine and senior author of the piece, to learn more. This interview has been lightly edited and condensed for clarity. What is the problem in academia right now? We know that now, for the first time ever, over half of all U.S. medical students are female. And despite the fact that women really started entering the profession many decades ago, we have not seen a similar diversification of medical school department chairs or deans. When we see that women have constituted over 40% of medical school faculty, but under 20% of leaders, we start to worry that it's not just the long time it takes to get through the pipeline, but other reasons as well. Why do you think the problems persist? In my mind, there are three major challenges: unconscious biases that exist, overt discrimination and harassment, and finally, gender division of labor, where women in our society bear a greater burden of domestic responsibility for childcare or elder care. These come together to make it more challenging for women to ascend senior leadership positions in academic medicine. Why term limits? The tendency is for leaders to remain in those positions for a long time. There are people who have been serving for 43 years. In academic medicine, clinical departments in particular have access to very large budgets, and department chairs tend to wield substantial power to allocate these funds. Even a very altruistic person will tend to want to have continued access to those resources. But institutions should consider whether at some point there's diminishing, marginal returns to the implementation of one person's vision, and if there's a benefit from bringing in other points of view. One of the big challenges is imposter syndrome, which is a feeling that one is not qualified to be where one is. It's often approached as an individual thing, but it's not exclusively that. We see that being more common in people who don't have role models in leadership. To some extent, diversifying the leadership can help transform and change that culture. Changing leadership could also lead to some differences in the type of research promoted. It's not just about achieving parity, but being more attuned to issues of equity, diversity, and inclusion. There are other benefits. A woman may not think that a 70-kilogram white male is the anatomic norm and a smaller black woman is a deviation from the norm. Diversity in leadership might actually ensure that there are adequate numbers of clinical trial participants who are women and minorities. The evidence is really compelling that when people from different life backgrounds and experiences interact, they come up with more innovative approaches that help not just women, but human health. It's not just about promoting gender equity to help women. In the end, diversity is also likely to help achieve our mission to help men as well as women. Okay, now shifting to environmental concerns, this from Bloomberg News. U.S. air quality was improving, now it's getting worse. After years of decline, a spike in air pollution may have taken the lives of almost 10,000 additional Americans over 2 years. Following a 24% drop between 2009 and 2016, particulate matter air pollution in the U.S. increased 5.5% in 2017 and 18, according to a new analysis of an EPA agency data by two Carnegie Mellon economists. The working paper published by the National Bureau of Economic Research may signal a deadly change in U.S. environmental health. "We have been making such steady progress regarding air quality," said C. Arden Pope, a Brigham Young University economist and specialist on pollution's threat to health. "This progress has resulted in substantial health benefits. It is disturbing to see what may be the beginning of deteriorating air quality in the U.S. Air pollution is the fifth leading cause of death around the world. Its primary component is particles smaller than 2.5 millionths of a meter, often referred to as particulate matter or PM2.5. While pollution of this kind varies by region, month, and even day, the negative changes observed by the researchers can't be explained away by such fluctuations," said study co-author Nicholas Muller. Muller and co-author Karen Clay looked at the substances hanging over U.S. cities and found evidence for three potential sources of the pollution rebound: increased economic activity, virulent wildfires, and a smaller number of EPA enforcement actions. It's important to note that the pair have not made any causal links between the three suspects and the increase of air pollution. The U.S. economy has picked up steam overall since 2017. More economic activity means more vehicles on the roads, driving more miles and emitting more pollutants. It also means more factories producing emissions along with consumer goods. Soot is another contributor to the pollution jump. The economists traced a rise in airborne carbon particles in part to wildfire activity in the West since 2016. Wildfire activity didn't play a role in the pollution decline through 2016, they said. Finally, they also looked at pollution enforcement trends. If polluters for some reason fail to follow Clean Air Rule Acts, PM2.5 can pick up. Clay and Mueller found that EPA enforcement activity has trended down since at least 2009. What does not make sense is why EPA enforcement actions have failed to rise along with pollution. That's a break in the broad pattern that we find interesting, Mueller said. The pair plan to study that question next. Okay, and sticking with environmental issues, this from Science Daily. Replacement flame retardants present serious risk, caution scientists. New flame retardants escaping from our TVs, other electrical and electronic products, and children's car seats are just as toxic as the flame retardants they're intended to replace, according to a peer-reviewed study published in Environmental Science and Technology Letters. The authors found that the replacement chemicals called organophosphate flame retardants have been associated with lower IQ in children, reproductive problems, and other serious health harms. Flame retardants pose a particularly grave threat to children. Babies are born with the same level as their mothers and are further exposed through hand-to-mouth behavior. Young children can have 3 to 10 times the flame retardant levels of adults, or even more. This can harm their developing brains and reproductive organs at this most vulnerable time. We need to realize that these flame retardants threaten the brain development of a whole generation, said retired National Institutes of Environmental Health Service Director Linda Birnbaum. Flame retardant chemicals aren't necessary or even effective for reducing fire hazard in many products. These chemicals are added to meet flammability regulations, but research shows that they often delay ignition only a few seconds and make fires more dangerous. After years of research and advocacy, dangerous flame retardants called polybrominated diphenyl ethers, PBDEs, were phased out of use in furniture foam, electronics, and children's products. While their phase-out was initially celebrated as a victory for human health, PBDEs have been swapped out with organophosphate flame retardants in many products. Like the old PBDE flame retardants, organophosphate flame retardants are continuously migrating out of products and dropping into dust. When dust contaminated with flame retardants gets on your hands, you can end up eating the flame retardants along with your sandwich. The scientists also found that levels of organophosphate flame retardants are often 10 to 100 times higher in air, dust, and water than the previous flame retardants. Most concerning of all, organophosphate flame retardants were found in nearly every person studied. Several were found at levels high enough to threaten fertility in adults and healthy brain development in children. These results show the danger of the whack-a-mole approach to chemical policy, said Marta Venier, an associate scientist at Indiana University. When manufacturers have to stop using a toxic chemical, they often replace it with a similar chemical with similar harms. In the case of flame retardants, we're jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire. For this study, the investigators reviewed nearly 100 peer-reviewed scientific papers on flame retardants. They compared research findings on the health effects, environmental harms, and chemical properties of the older PBDEs and newer organophosphates. They found that the replacement chemicals are carried by wind and water far from their origin, even to the ocean depths, icy mountaintops, and Earth's poles. Organophosphates are now found worldwide, polluting areas where flame retardants were never used. The authors call for manufacturers to increase fire safety in furniture, electronics, and children's products with creative designs and inherently fire-resistant materials. Our findings demonstrate the importance of dealing with these chemicals as a class rather than individually. While policies are heading in that direction, we can act now to reduce unnecessary use to protect human and environmental health. It's disheartening that after years of health harm to our children with PBDE flame retardants, the most widely used replacement appears to be just as bad. To protect future generations, manufacturers can and must stop the cycle of toxic substitutions and avoid unneeded flame retardants altogether. Okay, well, that's all we have time for in today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's toppun.com. If you'd like to review this show, any previous show, or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.